This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. And some of the most popular music in America today is country and western. And believe it or not, much of its sound began in Hawaii. The steel guitar is a familiar sound in country music, and the roots of the steel guitar based in 19th and early 20th century Hawaii with musicians like Sam Coo West. But through the decades of tourism and international migration, the steel guitar began to influence musicians, country, blues, all kinds of musicians, some who literally spoke to us. That's just irresistible. The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill is now celebrating the past and present of the Steel Guitar, Southern Folklife Collection, sponsoring Steel Guitar Concert and Symposium this Saturday, March 22nd, at the Arts Center in Carrboro. Tim Miller is a PhD student in musicology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's going to present at the symposium this weekend and joins us on the program to talk about the history of the steel guitar. Tim, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the steel guitar itself. How did it become part of Hawaiian culture?
Well, essentially, you had a lot of movement into Hawaii from other cultures in the world, and among those were some ranchers from Mexico, and I think there were also some directly coming from Portugal, or maybe from Portugal through Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, they brought with them the musical instruments that they had that were easy to transport, which has been a big part of the guitar's spread through a lot of places in the world. And from there, it just seeped into that culture. At the same time, a lot of other Western culture was coming in, like with the missionaries bringing in church music and things like that. So the indigenous culture that was in Hawaii already merged with the other Western elements. And from there, you got these unique little bits that developed there, like the ukulele, and then the slack key guitar, which is actually a open tuning system for playing regular guitar. And from there, we had the steel come in.
And do we think, because we think we know that the guitar itself originated as a gourd instrument, maybe Northern Africa, makes its way to Spain by way of the Moors,
sure,
then comes to the New World. Do we think there were stringed instruments of any kind in Hawaii before these ranchers made their way?
Thinking back to, there's a great book from like the 20s, Ancient Hawaiian Music.
Oh, yeah, I have that.
Yeah, Helen Roberts. And I think that like a lot of cultures on islands and in their places like that, there was a strong vocal base.
Yeah,
I don't think there was any major stringed instrument tradition, if anything.
So how do we think the guitar then evolved into the steel guitar on in Hawaii?
Well, in Hawaii, there's some conflicting reports because the idea of using a foreign object to stop the strings does appear in some other cultures dating back at least hundreds, if not more than that, years. We have several examples in Japan. We have an example in India, both south and north. And there's some European zithers like dulcimers that have wooden noters. You see that in the Appalachian style. So all that's sort of floating around. But the exact origin in Hawaii is largely credited to a guy named Joseph Kakuku, who several stories, but through means accidental or intentional, one day just dropped or placed a wooden or a metal railroad spike on the guitar and went, hey, that's kind of neat, and really developed the style from there.
I heard he was just trying to keep people from stealing it, so he was going to just drive that. I'm making it up. But that's how a lot of the show gets done, you know.
Sure.
So I want to hear, you talked about Joseph Kakuku, and we have an example of his music right here. There we have a little bit of Joseph Kakuku credited with sort of originating the steel guitar. And we should probably now talk about what it is. You talked about the fact there's,
sure,
a metal spike that may have been used to kind of create the sound. So what are we talking about when we say steel guitar?
Sure. Well, there's a few elements that are essential. But it started as a modification of a regular guitar. So basically, if you take the guitar, put it face up in your lap so that the strings are up. I don't know what came first. I think the bar came first. So you put a metal bar of some weight onto the string, and you just get this kind of shimmery tone. And you can slide between the notes. You end in the blues tradition, which uses the bottleneck, of course, they really exploit that to be able to play not on the frets. So with a guitar, you're usually bound to the notes that are installed with the frets. And a lot of African-American music especially, but a lot of other music too, uses notes that are between our Western scale. So with the steel, you're able to just, you know, move it a fraction of an inch and you've got a whole different note.
Right.
But to facilitate the style of playing with the face up, Kukuku also raised the strings up. So rather than being right there where you could press down on them with your fingers of your left hand, you raise them up about quarter of an inch to a half an inch, and it increases the volume of the instrument a little bit, but it also frees you up to have the bar kind of have a little leeway without hitting the neck.
Right. So you can get an extra tone or set of tones because now, as you say, you're not pressing against the neck, and you can apply more pressure because it's on your lap. You can press down rather than across. Yeah.
And so there's a lot of the sound comes from moving the bar slightly, the vibrato, and then you can slide up the neck without any interruption by frets. But then the other essential elements are the finger picks. So this just like a banjo player, you have a plastic pick on your thumb, two metal picks on your first two fingers. So you're playing with this three-note style. And that's basically the elements that were there, except for the tuning. So with a bar, you can't move your fingers in different relationships like you would on a regular guitar chord, changing the length of the strings, just putting your fingers on a different fret.
On individual strings, yeah.
So instead, and this comes from the slack key tradition in Hawaii, where they just have the strings tuned to an open chord. So you can just strum the open strings and you got a chord. You put your whole finger across another fret, you've got another perfect chord. So it's kind of like a capo in the folk tradition. But with the bar, you know, the bar kind of limits you if you're playing straight across to the notes. So just have an open chord there. But you can bend and you can turn it and get one or two frets difference between that.
Right.
And that's a big part of the early style.
So then how did this get back to the United States or back to North American continent?
Sure. We're in the 1890s, you know, America, the United States annexed Hawaii, sort of without asking if they were okay with it.
Bad habit.
Yes, indeed it was. But this was largely because of business and the agriculture there. Sugarcane was a huge crop, and it still is a major producer of sugarcane. So this was a big money thing going on there. But at the same time, they realized, hey, this is a great place. We're going there anyway. We can try to get people to pay to go there. So this is the birth of the tourist industry.
Sure.
But at the same time, you had all these shows or exhibitions is the main word in Chicago. There was a big one in Seattle in 1915. So the Hawaiian musicians were actually brought over and play these shows very early in the century. So I think that recording you played that had Kukuku on it was made in the States in about 1909, 1910, somewhere around there. So by this point, these musicians are already coming over. So you kind of simultaneously have this marketing of Hawaii, you know, the hula girl with the leis, and the music coming into the sonic soundscape. A lot of these old recordings are on Edison cylinders. So they sold a bunch, but still not seeping into the culture as much. But they're appearing at these exhibitions. And the other gentleman who's going to be talking at the symposium with me is really he's one of the leading scholars on Hawaiian stuff right now. And he's actually traced the movements of some of these Hawaiian musicians through the South in the teens and 20s. And he's uncovered a lot of really great information that we hadn't already had access to.
And so inevitably, it's going to integrate itself, the instrument in indigenous forms here, music of the Americas. But initially, it was Hawaiian music on this instrument.
Absolutely.
How is it being received? I mean, this is also a period of great immigration in the United States. So we're seeing music from all sorts of cultures coming to the United States. How is this music received, and what was its attraction?
Well, I mean, the Hawaiian guitar and the ukulele really melded with this plucked string tradition. So we had mandolin clubs, banjo clubs, dating back into the mid-19th century. So it really found a home there. But at the same time, it spread out into because that was largely a upper middle class, urban kind of deal. They were dealing with notation. So you get these from I have a book from 1914, I think, which is written by an American about how to play the Hawaiian guitar. So it's written down a couple Hawaiian tunes, but then we're right on to Stephen Foster and some light classical music and Camptown Races. So it becomes merged with a music that's already in America pretty quickly, and that also spreads to the rural situations, and that's where. Lots of debate about where the blues guitar comes from.
Yeah. Maybe the bottleneck in particular, yes. Bottleneck style. Well, we'll talk more about that. The influences of the steel guitar as it made its way from Hawaii to the U.S. Tim Miller, PhD student in musicology at UNC Chapel Hill. Just ahead, we'll continue to explore the history and sounds of the steel guitar. But before that, we leave you with this song, Lei E, by Kamala's Quartet. And then we'll return and talk some more on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about the history of the steel guitar. Tim Miller's a PhD student in musicology at UNC Chapel Hill. Alan Love joins us now. Alan is a steel guitarist and director of operations at North Carolina Symphony. Alan made a career of the pedal steel in the 1960s in Nashville, Tennessee, and he's going to play some pedal steel live for us on the State of Things and talk some more about it. Alan, welcome to the State of Things.
Great to see you again, Frank. Thanks for having me.
When were you introduced to the pedal steel?
Well, in the 60s, like a lot of people, I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey, not really the steel guitar capital of the world, but we got to hear a little bit of steel guitar in some of the records like the Birds and the Flying Burrito Brothers and Poco and Judy Collins. Buddy Emmons played a beautiful solo on Someday Soon, which I heard that and I had to learn how to play the instrument. It was just so beguiling.
And did you know right away it was a steel guitar, or did you say, what's that, and then have to go find
it? It really
out.
Was yeah. the what is that?
Yeah.
Not many steel guitars in New Jersey.
No.
So it took me a while to actually find one. It took me actually many years before I could actually put my hands on one.
And how about then? That means there weren't many steel guitar teachers in New Jersey.
None,
so how'd you learn?
None, zero. I got to say, though, growing up in Princeton, right around the same time, Buddy Miller lived right around the corner from me, as did Mary Chapin Carpenter. So there was a little. There must have been something in the water back then that got us all interested in this music.
How did you learn, though?
After college, I moved to Wisconsin, and there was a lot of steel guitarists out there. And I finally
why is that?
I don't know, but there was a gentleman out there in Milwaukee named Ralph Hansel.
Because you can actually play them with frozen sausage if you don't have a guitar, if you don't have a railroad
right.
spike. I don't
Bratwurst.
Know.
And there was a guy named Ralph Hansel in Milwaukee who had a basement full of hundreds of steel guitars. Wow. And I ended up at his house one day. I was about 22 years old, and just ended up getting a guitar from him,
and kind of teaching yourself. Yeah,
and started teaching myself.
Yeah,
there weren't too many teachers around. But
did you play guitar?
Yes, I've been playing guitar, piano, and drums. You know, I played rock bands when I was in high school.
Is it a difficult transition, or is it like going from tennis to badminton or something?
Kind of like that.
Yeah,
you know, if you know the theory, you can figure it out pretty quickly.
Yeah. So, and then you ended up at the Grand Ole Opry, right?
Right. Went about as far as I could go playing up in Madison, Wisconsin, and moved to Nashville. Just took a shot at it, Ended up in Nashville sleeping on a couch, and about 3 months later I had a gig playing with Jean Shepherd on the Grand Ole Opry and played with her for about a year.
So this means this instrument is now important to country music.
Absolutely.
And had it become – was it growing in importance, or by the time you got there it was an essential instrument?
It was already pretty well established by the time I got there. Tim can tell you about more about the history than I certainly can.
Well, that's what I wanted. I'm going to ask you right now, Tim, how that happened, then how it becomes an instrument.
Well, the short story, it kind of got adopted pretty quickly in the 20s by vernacular singers. Jimmie Rodgers, who we know is so important to country music history, used it along with everything else. you know, he had one session with Louis Armstrong. And soon after, he's playing with some Hawaiian guys in Texas. And there were some other musicians who played on the Bristol Sessions in 1927. That was this kind of Ralph Peer came down and made all these recordings of the Carter family, Jimmy Rogers. So it's out there. There's another brother duo in North Carolina, the Dixon Brothers, who had the steel guitar. So it's really out there at this point. But heading into modern country music, it really came through Western swing. And there in the mid-30s, we had a guy named Bob Dunn in Texas who was one of the first to actually amplify the acoustic steel guitar. And from there, very quickly, we get the first electric instruments, which are, instead of having an acoustic guitar that you've modded out, you have just a piece of wood with some strings on it. And once you get that, it opens it up to adding strings to it. You can now have two sets of strings rather than one, because there were lots of different tunings that people used. And that's really important to where the pedal steel came from. So electrified, it becomes a sort of mechanical device.
On a pedestal now. It's not on your lap all the time.
Yeah, either way at this point. Once you get into 3 and 4 necks, you got to put it on legs.
Right.
You know, in the 30s, people were already trying to figure out a ways, like, I want to use different tunings, but I don't want to have to turn the pegs. So let me come up with some crazy system. So I've looked at close to 100 patents from the 20s up through now, of people who had this mission to mechanically change the tuning of the instruments.
And in terms of its appeal, I mean, there is that kind of very lyrical vocal quality to country music that is so well suited to the sound of the steel guitar, right?
Yeah, and the electrification just added to that, really made it a singing quality. So then once it gets into country music, the comedians are using it, and you get the dobro introduced into the Grand Ole Opry by Cousin Jody, who played with Roy Acuff. And so there's an element of that crying thing, like you heard the talking steel guitar of Pete Drake, but there's this sort of human voice thing that happens. And so that's been a trope of the whole history, the crying. And it's really the important aesthetic of country music. And there's even some people that say, well, the men who sing, they're too manly to do the crying. So that's why we have the steel guitar to fill that role.
The sacred feminine makes its way to Nashville.
That's pretty much
beautiful.
It,
beautiful. Alan, would you play a song for us now?
I'm going to play something called Bud's Bounce. It's one of the earlier examples of the introduction of pedals to the guitar.
And this is really coming more from the swing style, so this is a little bit more of an up number.
There's a little bit of Bud's Bounce, and Alan Love is on the steel guitar, along with Tim Miller on the bass. Tim's a PhD student in musicology at UNC Chapel Hill. Alan is a steel guitarist and director of operations at North Carolina Symphony, and they're going to be at a symposium starting March 23rd on the steel guitar. Oh, there's a concert, in fact, and symposium at the Arts Center in Carrboro this Saturday, and we're getting a little sample right now. So there's the sound. Was it an easy transition? And was it mostly in country music? Because we talked about the blues too, and it kind of found its
absolutely.
Way into that.
Well, we had a sort of a splintering because in the 20s and 30s, with the Jimmie Rodgers and Jimmy Davis and some of those other acts, the language of the blues slide and the Hawaiian slide were really intermingled. And you get a lot of freedom moving between these notes. But once we got into the jazz vocabulary of Western swing, and adding 8, 10 strings to the instrument, chords became a lot more of the vocabulary in the Western swing and country. So we get back to more of a solid intonation idea, mm-hmm. rather than the fluid,
right.
which carries on in the blues tradition. And there is the sacred steel tradition, if you've ever heard of that, in the African-American churches. That really builds on this free, melismatic, which is lots of moving notes style. It was really big in country music. Electric instruments became really big in honky tonk. Ernest Tubb introduced the electric guitar because they're playing in bars, and it was, you know, you needed to cut through there. So that's how the electrified stuff came in there. But the steel guitar was really big in the 40s on pop records like Eddie Arnold. But the introduction of the pedals really amped it up. They had been floating around in the 40s. Speedy West, who was a Western swing player, had them, and Alvino Ray even earlier than that. But they didn't use them overtly. They really were kind of behind the scenes, like tricks of the trade. They even had a piece of wood covering the front of the instrument so people couldn't see what they were doing. So there was this hiddenness to it.
The steel guitar of Oz.
That's right.
Let me ask you about the pedals. Is the same function as on a piano, the dynamic, it controls the dynamics?
The pedals change the tension. The pedals change the tension on the strings, and that gives you the raises and the lowers that are characteristic of the sound. So something like this.
You're changing the pitch, not just the dynamics.
To an A chord and back to E.
Wow, so that's unique. Do any other instruments do that? We change pitch with your feet?
Well, you do it on a harp, but actually they're changing the actual length of the string and not the actual tension on the string.
Yeah. So the harp is the biggest example, and a lot of the early pedal steels were called like electro harp, and that goes with what those guys are doing. It was a binary state, like we were in one tuning and we hit the pedals down, and now we're in this other tuning. But Bud Isaacs, who wrote Bud Bounce, brought into country music, he's the guy who really is important for introducing this, is using them like Alan just did. You play the strings and then you hit them and you go back. So there's this motion within the notes that are happening that's audible, and you hear the bending between the notes.
Give us another sample of that, will you, Alan, just so we can hear that again. So this and now this is also an instrument that will remind you of a zither or a dulcimer. Were those instruments independently developed, or did they have some relationship to this?
Sure. I mean, technically, the pedal steel is a zither if you go by the the academic definition of instruments. But culturally, it's very much a guitar. But there isn't really a lot of overlap in that development. It's there, but not really so much important to this tradition, because it was guitar makers who were building these things.
Mm-hmm. And you say there's a controversy when it comes to the blues, because we know the tradition of slide or a slide guitar, right, or bottleneck, where a guitarist might use a piece of glass, a glass or a steel cylinder, work his way up and down the fretboard. Were they developed independently, or this is where the fight starts?
And it's very few people fighting about this. like I said earlier, there's evidence of these instruments and still existing traditions in other places of the world, including Africa. And in any study of the blues, we try to really account for the things that were transferred over and survived the journey from here to Africa, or from Africa to here, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they certainly were commingling by the teens and 20s. And people have some strong opinions about whether that is. And I think that's – if we find some great evidence, that would be great. But I think the beauty is in really looking at how the musicians interact.
Well, and it's such an obvious innovation. If you're playing the guitar, it is so obvious that at some point somebody's going to pick up a slide-like tool and start playing it whether or not they've ever heard slack key or steel guitar. You can imagine it can work its way in. Would you play another song for us?
Sure. Well, why don't we have Alan play a solo piece here? And this is an arrangement by Buddy Emmons, who was one of the great innovators of the old folk tune Wild Mountain Time. Thank you.
There's a song called Wild Mountain, written by Buddy Emmons and performed here by Alan Love, who, along with my other guest, Tim Miller, is going to be performing at the Arts Center in Carrboro, a steel guitar concert and symposium, Saturday, March 23rd. So, Alan, is there a lot of music written for steel guitar these days or in the past decade?
A lot of the stars of the steel guitar have written instrumentals over the years. You don't hear them very often unless you're really an aficionado of the instrument and play it.
And is it easy enough to adapt other tunes to the steel guitar?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you're finding the steel guitar in just almost every genre these days. Jazz, blues, country, of course, classical. I played a steel guitar concerto with the North Carolina Symphony about 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And so it's very popular now in indie rock. So, I do a lot of actually sessions with indie rock bands.
Well, tell us about its further than its development and evolution, Tim. We
sure.
found out how it got to Nashville. Then what happens?
Yeah. Well, once we start changing the chords a little bit, that idea gets out there. And this is one of the really neat things about it is that the idea of this technology is moving through sound across the whole country. And it sort of happened with the Hawaiian, too, with the recordings, to the extent that the recordings were driving it. But it, just like that, what is that sound? How is he doing that becomes this thing. And almost every steel guitar player out there who was alive in that time says that, oh, you know, I heard that, and I went to my garage and got some fishing line and a gas pedal from a Model T Ford and and slapped something together. You don't see a lot of these instruments, but, you know, people were definitely making things themselves. But by the late 50s, we had the birth of dedicated makers. I mean, the one by Isaac's played had been made by Paul Bigsby in California, who's a pretty well-known maker, but he only made one instrument a month. So there was a waiting list about, you know, several years long. And so there was this big gap. And that got filled first in Nashville by Shot Jackson, working with Buddy Emmons, the player. Shot Jackson was also a player, but he was also a machinist. And he started by adding pedals to other people's instruments. I've talked to some people even in North Carolina who sent their guitars away and got them mailed back with pedals. And so they start making the dedicated pedal steels, very, very much inspired by Bigsby. Fender gets in the game and has some really interesting innovations, but the instruments are kind of, they're designed a little bit differently and they don't quite hold up the same way. They become very popular on the West Coast, largely because Fender was just giving them out to these guys.
Right.
But they have a very special sound. So the Fender sound is one thing, but the Nashville sound really was Showbud for the late 50s, early 60s. But then Emmons broke out on his own and had some design ideas, and that became the Emmons Guitar Company, which is right here in North Carolina.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's an industry here. Yeah.
They were big in, through the 80s and 90s,
yeah.
And they're still there, but the demand is not. We really had a peak of the industry, and it's not as big anymore.
And when you say when you were with the Opry, Alan, that it's interesting that it was kind of a young man's game, a very young man's game, to play this instrument. Is that right?
I don't know about that. There was a lot of real legends playing on the Opry
when I got there. Yeah.
Weldon Myrick, Hal Rugg.
Yeah,
were the staff steel players, and they had established session careers back in the 60s. Yeah. And
The boom of the young guys was really in the 50s.
Yeah,
and
this
Emmons and his cohort were 18, 19 years old, and they really this core of players really dominated going forward. And a lot of those guys started in either the late 50s or early 60s. And there's always been new players coming up, but there's some really great players out now playing for guys like Dierks Bentley. I think Tim Sargent is his name. Fabulous young player. And Brad Paisley. These are guys that have a dedicated pedal steel player. For a long time, it was like, you know, you have the guy, you pay him to come in the studio, may or may not have somebody on the road playing the steel. But it's great to see young bands having this relationship, because that was really important. Emmons played with Ernest Tubb for a number of years, and then Jimmy Day, and then Emmons played with Ray Price, and that repertoire is really what defined the pedal steel sound.
Back then, the road players were playing on the albums, which is pretty rare in Nashville.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, that may be because there was a choice number of
that's right.
accomplished
yeah. mm-hmm.
steel guitar players. Well, I'm going to let you play us out here in a second. I want to find out about what's going on in Hawaii. Has it evolved in Hawaii in the same way it has here?
It kind of came back there, and there definitely has been moves throughout the years to revitalize. You do see a lot of electric instruments now. A guy named Jerry Bird, who was one of the great practitioners of the non-pedal steel in the 40s and 50s, went back and moved to Hawaii and really did a lot with players there. But there's still a lot of native musicians. You don't see a lot of pedals. The non-pedal tradition is still really big. And actually, our concert on Saturday features one of the great American non-pedal players, Sidney Cashdollar, who's been playing for quite a long time and is just a genius of the non-pedal.
Sounds like it's going to be a great event. Thank you so much for being on the program. Thanks to both of you. Tim Miller, PhD student in musicology, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Alan Love, steel guitarist and director of operations at the North Carolina Symphony. Tim and Alan are presenting this Saturday, March 23rd at the Steel Guitar Concert and Symposium Arts Center in Carrboro. And they're going to play us out as we get ready for our next segment on the state of things. Stay tuned.